I'm speaking today with Austin Ivory, who's a UK-based Catholic journalist, a biographer of Pope Francis, and has recently been appointed Fellow in Contemporary Church History at Campion Hall, Oxford University. Austin has an article in Commonweal's February 22nd issue about the upcoming Global Summit on Clerical Sex Abuse, which will be taking place between February 20th and February 24th. We're speaking on February 7th, before the summit takes place. I thought we'd start, Austin, by talking about the Pope's own remarks about what we should and should not expect from the summit. On a flight from Panama on January 27th, he told reporters that we have to deflate expectations. And then he described the summit as being essentially about catechesis. What did he mean by that?
I think he meant catechesis in the sense that it's education and awareness. But that doesn't mean it isn't also hard-hitting, because what he wants the bishops of the world to be aware of, and this is, let's remember, the first ever global summit of presidents and bishops' conferences, he wants them all to go home knowing exactly how they need to respond to any case, any allegation of abuse that comes their way, how to act on behalf of victims, but also to make sure that they listen to victims. So I think there'll be a strong element, really, of making the church, particularly in Asia and Africa, aware of the kind of protocols, guidelines and canon law that exists at the moment and that is used and has been used for at least 15 years in the northern world. So I think partly that's the purpose, is awareness. But really, I think there's a deeper purpose, which is what I tried to bring out in the article, which is that he's aiming, I think, at a change of culture. And that, I think, is the bigger picture.
Near the beginning of your article, you write that this isn't just about the United States. And, of course, we're speaking in the United States, and most of our listeners are in the United States or in the English-speaking world. But you point out that this summit isn't just about the crisis. It's been in the headlines here. But the problem throughout the world, in Africa and Asia and Latin America, and you write that in those places, they don't think they have an abuse crisis, but they do.
And actually, that's really well known. I mean, I know African cardinals who will just say to you, no, this is not our problem. You know, if we have any of these cases in Africa, it's because it's a foreign missionary. But actually, it's just not true. I mean, we know from stories that have come to light even many years ago of nuns with AIDS who have been abused by priests. And actually, anybody who knows the African scene particularly knows that, for example, you get an African priest who is in receipt of large sums of foreign aid money to help with development, say, coming from Germany or America. That priest very quickly becomes a very powerful figure locally. He becomes a kind of a sugar daddy, and many people come to depend on him and look up to him. Now, it's very easy in those circumstances for that person to be corrupted by that power and to start to demand things. So instead of serving people, he makes use of them, he exploits them. And then it's not just the act of abuse, it's also the fact that then nobody wants to talk about it, because, of course, if you question or challenge him, then, you know, everything unravels and your source of welfare disappears. That's the kind of corruption that the Pope really wants to address. In other words, he wants the church everywhere to see that this culture of corruption, which really we can summarize in the word clericalism, because it's a whole mentality, is prevalent everywhere, and that's what needs to be dealt with above all.
Now, the argument you make in the article you wrote for us, well, you make a couple arguments, but I'd say the main one is that we need institutional reform, new norms, new guidelines, but all of the institutional reform, all the juridical reform in the world will be unavailing unless there's a metanoia, you say, a conversion. The Holy Spirit is calling the church to recenter itself, to change its focus, in fact. And you think this is in keeping with the Pope's larger vision of the church's future.
And I say this simply because I spent a lot of last year following very carefully, particularly the crisis in Chile, which I was very, very aware of. I was out there with him and so on. And then obviously, during the year, you had Chile crisis, you had McCarrick, you had the grand jury report, you had the Australian and German reports, and the Pope then responding, of course, with the People of God letter on August the 20th. You then had, at the end of the year, his address to the Curia, and you had his letter to the US bishops as they went on retreat in January. So you actually have seen a kind of rich encyclical, almost, of his own teaching on this, his own discernment, which you can see is growing and changing. So I'm going to just try and sum it up in a way, probably way too crudely, but I think it's quite important in a way to nail it. At the heart of this, he's come to see, is a kind of corruption, which is a loss of ecclesial centre. So Christ has been forgotten, and the church has become the centre of attention, both its bella figura, the maintenance of it, and then, of course, when that fails, then it's the sin and the scandal of the church then becomes the centre of attention. And at the root of that is a forgetting or a turning away from the vision of the church at the Second Vatican Council in Lumen Gentium, of the church as people of God. So what has happened is that the institution has withdrawn from the people of God. God hasn't withdrawn from the people of God. God is still present in the people of God. But because the institution has withdrawn from the people of God and God has turned its back on Christ, then it is in a situation of corruption. The revelations, the crises, the scandals are the prophet Nathan, you know, recalling David to what he's done. And that in this crisis, in this scandal, in this revelation of corruption, there is a grace of conversion which is being offered to the church, just as it's offered to every one of us who has to go into the situation. And the grace is what? The grace is to convert to being who we really are and who we are really called to be, which is to put Christ then back at the centre. So I see his role as a bit like a spiritual director leading a group on a retreat through a process of conversion, getting them to face what's happened, why it's happened, to face their sin, and then to accept the grace of conversion and not be distracted by the various temptations along the way which prevent us accepting that grace.
And what are some of those temptations?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at his letters to Chile, the Chilean bishop, he's constantly warning them against what one might call the great Latin American vice, which is of talking, talking, talking. And, you know, I know the Chilean hierarchy. You know, they're a very educated, you know, slightly kind of hieratic lot. And, you know, faced with some of this stuff, they've taken refuge in what one might call endless reasons and arguments. Oh, but we've done this and prayer. With the US bishops, it's very interesting. He said, don't try and take refuge in, you know, what the American vice is, which is programs and juridical mechanisms. Because what happens is, in the first case, you've got really a kind of denial. And in the second case, in the American case, what's the problem? You're putting the institution always at the center. Actually, we don't exist for the institution. The institution exists for God, for Christ, for the purpose of evangelization. So I think the evasion mechanisms are different in each case. For somebody who's studied this Pope's thinking and writing over many years, I know his writings as a Jesuit, and what's been fascinating in 2018 is to see how he's drawing on his own very deep, fascinating writings on institutional desolation in the 1990s, and he's been, which are fascinating, and he's been using the lessons from that now this year in 2018-2019 in guiding the church now through its institutional desolation.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment, just to draw out the logic of your argument. Some people would say, some people have said, in fact, in a response to your article that's already appeared because we published your piece online before it appears in print, Christopher R. Altieri, writing at the Catholic World Report, points out that in many cases, institutional changes cause or help foster cultural changes. And so the idea that we have to wait for metanoia before we can begin to implement the sort of juridical reforms that many see as necessary to curb clerical abuse of all kinds, sexual abuse of children, sexual abuse of adults, that idea is sort of an illusion. And also maybe an evasion of its own way, insofar as it leads us to think that the problem is purely a spiritual one.
I get Altieri's objections. I see the logic and the force of them. He says law leads culture. Institutional reform helps to produce the cultural change. I totally get the argument, but he's setting up a false opposition because there's absolutely no way that Francis is opposed to institutional reform. And in fact, throughout his pontificate, he's been carrying out institutional reforms to help the church better respond to this issue. But it's interesting, isn't it? When I mean, on Twitter, I pressed, you know, Altieri and said, well, yeah, what do you mean by institutional reform? What are the measures? And I didn't get a straight answer. Mm-hmm. And I think this is partly, I think, the problem with the U.S. church's response to the Pennsylvania grand jury report and indeed McCarrick last year. You know, let's set up a commission. Let's get some lay people exercising oversight over bishops and let's do this. All these kind of mechanisms that are coming, but actually, they've worked pretty well on the whole, the mechanisms from Dallas. The Pennsylvania grand jury report showed it. Now, there is more to do, and particularly the area of Episcopal accountability. And yet, again, and Altieri, I don't think, would accept this, and many of the critics wouldn't, but actually the 2016 canonical measure introduced by Francis, called Like a Loving Mother, Comune Madre Amorevole, actually makes it very easy for the Pope to stand down any bishop who has been simply incompetent in the area of handling abuse. And I think what's happening, going to happen in the February summit, is he's going to say to the bishops, if you have a case of abuse, however long ago, this is how you have to respond. Dum, 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 dum. And if you don't, I'm going to stand you down. Because actually he has the power to. So I don't think that new juridical mechanisms, of course they could always be improved, but they're not the heart of it. And you know, the real experts on this, and I'm talking here about Father Hans Zollner of the Gregorian University, who everybody would accept is the leading expert on this, he said it himself. He said, yes, let's clarify certain procedures. Let's make sure everybody knows what the procedures are. But that procedures aren't going to change it. As long as you have the clericalist mentality, you're going to get cover-up. And by the way, if you want an example of that, it's Chile. You know, Chile had actually lots of protocols and guidelines in place. But when Scicluna was sent out by Pope Francis to get at the truth about the Barros case, he uncovered a massive institutional corruption, which nobody, and I can tell you I've been out in Chile a lot these last few years, nobody was talking about, not in the media. You know, it wasn't, you know, Chilean church was saying, Francis, there's huge corruption. No, nobody was saying it. It was all hidden. And I, when I spoke to Archbishop Scicluna about this, he said, because that's the mentality that you get into if you are trying to, you know, basically once cover-up begins, it spreads. So no amount of mechanisms, oversight, you know. So this idea that there's some kind of imaginary FBI who you can call in to clean up the institution and kick out the bad guys, that's not the way the church operates.
Right. So there's not a perfect system that will prevent all cases of sexual abuse. And even with the best system in the world, you need the right orientation, the right spirit animating it, or the system will simply break down or be insufficient.
I think I'd put it like this. You're never going to get rid of abuse. Right. Abuse is part of the human condition. What you can do is create a culture reflected, yes, in laws and regulations, but fundamentally a culture which is so appalled by abuse that it acts against it and it acts to expel it. And that's what we need to create in the church. But we can only do that when we move away from a clericalist church and move towards a church as a people of God. Very interesting, in the preparation for the February summit, Father Lombardi, who's the moderator of the summit, talked about a reform of relations in the church. Now, you know, that sums it up very well. We have to change, and Francis has said it in various letters to the Chilean bishops, we have to change the way we use money, we use power, we have to change the way we treat the laity, how the laity are. You know, there is an ecclesiological understanding which is very clear in Lumen Gentium, which we have failed to implement. And the revelations now of the failures of the church in relation to abuse are, you know, is it the canary in the coal mine, you know, that's signalling where we have failed and why we failed. And the invitation then is to become really what we're called to be.
You've mentioned the crisis in Chile. Maybe you could say a little bit about how you think that crisis changed Pope Francis's own thinking about this problem.
I'm convinced, and I'm not the only one who's convinced, that quite a lot changed in January of 2018 in Francis's own mind. Now, because a quick recap, I mean, Francis had spent 3 years defending the appointment of a bishop that he had made, a bishop who had pleaded his innocence, but who was accused of involvement with and cover-up for the notorious priest, Father Fernando Caradima. Now, I think Francis was applying, before January 2018, he was applying his principles. And one of those principles is you defend the innocent, because actually priests and bishops are subject to false accusations. Most accusations are true, but some are false. We know that. And the innocent are innocent until they're proved guilty. And so he stuck to that principle, and he balanced that with other principles like listening to victims, like safeguarding. So he had his, I think it was 5 principles I've worked out that he was operating under. But what he realized in Chile was that that wasn't enough. Because, in fact, the picture that he had of the situation in Chile was a distorted one, because he was being told what the truth was by people who were actually part of the institutional desolation or corruption. And that's where I think he moved from seeing this as a case of, you know, sin and failure and so on, to actually seeing this as a matter of corruption. Now, this is a pope who's spent a lot of time thinking about corruption. He's from a country in which corruption exists in the church and in the state at a very high level. And he has a wonderful essay from 1991 called Sin and Corruption, in which he distinguishes between the two. And the difference is this. As somebody who is sinning, at some level, knows they're doing wrong and they're looking for a way out. So if you offer that person mercy, you know, if they're repentant, then you learn that, you know, God's forgiveness is waiting for you. Then, if you like, mercy creates the space for you to change. The corrupt person, however, is no use offering mercy because they don't think that they're doing anything wrong. They're in denial. They've created a complete false, if you like, double life. And they have started to believe even themselves that they haven't done anything wrong. And with people who are corrupt, you have to confront them. And it's usually, in an individual's case, it's only when, you know, their wife leaves them, their business collapses, they get terminal cancer or something, or the police knock at the door, like in all the police films. Yeah, that's when corruption is there. So he started to see this issue, and I think this is really significant. He started to see this as a matter of corruption. In other words, a bit like he needed an approach like the one he's taking with Vatican finances. In other words, you know, you need a massive shake-up in order to change the culture, and therefore only that kind of a radical... But now, in a way, he didn't have to bring in the police because the journalists have done it for him. And he said in his speech to the Curia at Christmas, he likened the role of the media in this to that of the prophet Nathan confronting David with his own corruption. But what you asked me about how he came to see it, I think he came to see it as a matter of corruption and that it wasn't essentially about sex. It's essentially about power. And that there is three abuses involved. There's abuse of power, abuse of conscience, and sexual abuse is part of it. So I think when Scicluna comes back with his report, the Pope says, wow, I've got this spectacularly wrong. And he has the extraordinary humility to say, you know, publicly, I messed up here. You know, wow, I've got this wrong. And then to say to the Chilean bishops, right, I want you all to come here. We're going to face this together. And then, you know, they offer their resignation and everything that's followed from that. So here you see a man, I think, who starts to see it as a matter of corruption and realises that something much more radical than the mere tinkering of protocols will take.
So we talked about what the Pope thinks or has said we should expect from the Bishop's Sex Abuse Summit in February. Maybe you could tell us what you expect to see. What are realistic expectations? And what do you hope for? What's the best-case scenario?
This is very mean because this podcast is going out after the...
True, and we can update it later. But
and you're asking me to make a prediction.
That's right.
Here's my prediction, and I'm fairly sure that this is true. I think the abuse victims, the survivors, groups who will be standing outside the Synod Hall with their placards will be interviewed every day by the press, and they will say nothing concrete. Everybody's just talking. You know, we want to see bishops' heads roll. We want to see blah, blah, blah. And I think the right wing in America, which has curiously come to, in many ways, share the view of you know, SNAP and so on, many of the survivors groups, which is, you know, they want their pound of flesh, they want to see a purge. I mean, in the case of the right wing, of course, they want to see a purge of gay people, they want to, the liberals, all the people that they see have compromised the modernity of the church. So various groups are going to express deep levels of disappointment. But I think what you're going to get is hopefully what happened in the Great Gregorian University Conference in 2012, you're going to get bishops coming out going, wow, you know, wow. And that hopefully is going to come across. You know, we're going to get bishops who are interviewed who are from Asia or Africa who can say, look, I really have been changed by this. And here's my other prediction. The Pope at the end of it is going to give one of his most important speeches, which is going to be like a summary of this encyclical, as I call it, you know, of 2018, which I did call the Chilean encyclical, but which now has to include the United States. Right. So I think his most important speeches, in which I think he will leave nobody in any doubt about where he stands and how he sees the opportunity of conversion being offered in this tribulation.
Austin Ivory, thank you very much for joining us. And maybe we'll talk again after the summit.
It's been great to be with you, Matt. Thanks.
I'm speaking again today with Austin Ivory about the Vatican Summit on Sex Abuse. Austin, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Matt.
When we last spoke, which was a couple of weeks before the summit, I offered you the chance to make a prediction about the summit, what would come of it, what the headlines might be. And one of your predictions was about the Pope's final statement or speech. You said that we should listen carefully to that. You thought it would be memorable and important. And I think it's fair to say that your prediction was confirmed by the headlines, at least. The Pope's speech did receive a lot of attention in the press, although much of it was negative. And so you've written for us again after the summit about why so many people were dissatisfied with the Pope's remarks at the end of the summit. First of all, were you surprised by what he said or didn't say at the end?
Yes. What I wasn't prepared for was that he would do a speech, the first third of which was essentially locating the clerical sex abuse crisis within the much larger context of exploitation against children in all kinds of spheres, but particularly in developing countries. That actually turned out to be the most controversial part of the speech, because the reaction of many of the victims' groups outside was, oh, he's trying to minimise, he's trying to relativise the church's abuse. Now, he wasn't trying to do that, and I'll come back to explain why he wasn't. And it wasn't very him, you know, so clearly that had been farmed out to somebody. It was full of statistics, and it didn't sound very much like him. Then he got going, and then I thought it was actually vintage him, because it was all about the conversion that needs to take place. Now, the problem, you know, when we discussed this last time, Matt, was that, you know, one of the predictions I made was that this is actually about conversion. It's about conversion of hearts and minds. That's what they're aiming for, because without that conversion, you know, you can have as many rules and norms and regulations as you like, but it's the conversion that's needed. However, I added, I think I said this anyway, but of course, everybody will say, well, it's too vague, you know. Well, that is exactly what's happened. So what happened in the summit was really quite remarkable. It's what I wrote about in the recent piece. And, you know, I was close to it and listening to people and hearing their testimonies. And there definitely some real shifts took place in that summit. And the Pope, at the beginning of it, said, we want concrete measures to come out of this. And of course, what happened at the end was that there were various announcements about various changes. But if you believe that this is a crisis or a situation that can only be solved through massive new stringent regulation, then of course you're going to be disappointed. So sure enough, you know, I was just reading the Washington Post piece, you know, it all sounded very vague. You know, the Pope didn't deliver on these concrete measures that he promised, and the victims groups outside, of course, saying very much the same thing. But I think what was going on there was that what you needed to understand was what this meeting was really about and what it was for. And its achievement, actually, to me, is very, very significant, because not only did the bishops of the world, particularly in Asia and Africa, where they don't think they've got a problem, but they do, not only were they converted to the cause, but more importantly, what went on inside the Synod Hall, which we journalists weren't party to, were lots of discussions about changes that need to take place in Rome and in the way these things are handled. Now, just today, and I'm speaking to you just a couple of days after the summit ends, two of the organisers of the summit, Cardinal Blaise Subic of Chicago and Archbishop Charles Scicluna of Malta, who's the adjunct secretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and probably the leading canon lawyer on this, both said very, very strongly, we need to end this idea that we don't find out which bishops have been stood down. Right. Now, this has been, for those who know the issue, this has been actually a very big source of frustration for the reformers. They say, okay, we now know that bishops are stood down if they cover up, but we never find out why. The people of God are never told. We just know they resign. Now, they're now saying confidently this is going to change. And I know from having spoken to both of them, you know, how frustrated they've been in the past over this. So what's happened is that clearly in the hall, there was a consensus about that, and the Pope now effectively has a mandate from the bishops to carry through these reforms. I've given you one example from one interview, but in fact, there have been other things that have been announced during the summit and since. In other words, the real changes, and they are concrete changes, are going to happen, but they're going to happen gradually, and they're going to be announced as they happen. But what's happened is that there's been a fundamental shift that has taken place in the institutional dynamics with which the church approaches abuse, which I think we will look back on this and say this was a signal moment. But of course, right now, a couple of days or even a week after the summit, you know, everybody's looking and saying, well, what did it achieve?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk in the press here in the United States about this being a lot of hot air, really, that the Pope gave his speech and used impressive rhetoric in denouncing the sin of sex abuse. But in the end, nothing significant change. There were no serious reforms that would have satisfied, for example, the victims' groups.
And the reason that they're saying that is that they're starting from a hermeneutic, an assumption that the way you deal with this issue is basically through judicial measures, through reforms in law and regulation. But in fact, that's not the way the church works. The church is in the business of conversion, not punishment, not policing. We don't really do that very well. We have an element of that, but the most important thing is conversion.
And it's also true, is it not, that it's difficult to come up with one-size-fits-all procedural reforms that will be adequate throughout the world, because the legal context and the law enforcement context is different in the United States and in much of the developed world than it is in other parts of the world. It may be that what works here won't work in exactly the same way that it works here somewhere else. So, for example, I know there's been the concern that if you promise to turn accused priests over to law enforcement in every country of the world, then you risk turning priests over to manifestly coercive states that may punish any accused priests without due process, or may punish priests too harshly for minor accusations.
Exactly right. Or indeed, it could be then used against the church to deprive it of essential freedoms. But that said, and that's true, and that's why Rome has always been reluctant to say, you know, this thing called zero tolerance, you know, what does it actually mean in practice? How do you enforce it in lots of different cultural contexts? But what you can do as a church, and you have to do as a church, because we stand for something. And if we don't stand for the safeguarding of children, if we don't stand against the misuse of power for exploitation of the vulnerable, then who are we? So clearly the church has to stand for against abuse of all sorts. And that's why wherever you are, Africa, Asia, America, Europe, wherever you are, the Catholic Church has to be seen and has to be known for that. But you're right on the particular procedural legal questions about, for example, involvement of civil authorities. That obviously is a very necessarily a local question. But what the church can say to every bishop in the world is, if you hear about one of your priests abusing, you must investigate. You must suspend the priest immediately if it's a credible accusation. And you must inform Rome, you must inform the CDF, and a process will begin, which will lead to that, to the removal of that priest from ministry, because there is no room in the priesthood for anybody who abuses the young. The church can be absolutely clear about that. And in fact, the CDF are publishing what they call a Vademecum, a handbook, which will make it absolutely clear to every bishop of the world exactly how they need to respond to this.
And what about bishops who fail to follow that rule? A lot of people would say that the major problem now is that bishops themselves aren't accountable when they fail to report priests who are credibly accused of abuse, and that we need to go a higher level, that we've got workable protocols in place, for example, the Dallas Charter, for the priests themselves who are accused of misconduct. But the bishops who cover up for them are still not adequately accountable.
That has been the big issue. That's been the big issue, really, of this pontificate, and that from the very beginning, it was clear that this would be the next stage of the reform of this area. I don't agree, though, that bishops aren't now held accountable. We have actually even before the 2016 motu proprio that Francis brought in, actually quite a large number of bishops were stood down over this. But since the 2016 edict, it's very, very clear that any bishop anywhere in the world who fails to act properly to defend his flock and fails to take action against an abuser priest will be stood down. The motu proprio is called Come una madre amoreva, like a loving mother, makes clear that this specifically relates to sex abuse, and that there literally can be never any justification for failing to act. So I think actually the law is now very clear. I think what the concern, there are two concerns now over this. One is that we need to make sure every bishop understands what they have to do, hence the Vademecum, hence, by the way, the summit. The whole point of bringing these bishops together was so that they're absolutely clear on this. And then secondly, we need greater transparency in keeping the people of God informed about what is happening. So this was something that came up a lot in the summit. Okay, we know Come una madre amorevole is working. We know a substantial number of bishops, I reckon it's something like 16, have been stood down in the last few years over that legislation. But we never hear about it. The Vatican doesn't tell us. And that's why I say earlier that it was a very significant announcement from Archbishop Scicluna and Cardinal Subic to say, actually, there is no reason why Rome cannot tell us. It's ridiculous to take this confidentiality stuff and apply it. You know, if a bishop has done wrong and he's asked to stand down before the age of 75 because of that, well, we need to be told. And I think there's an accountability and a transparency issue there. But I don't think there's any ambiguity now over what will happen to bishops if they cover up.
You think the faithful can be confident that rule will be enforced? I mean, I think transparency is certainly an important issue. But there's a lot of, as you know, there's a lot of suspicion that in the end, no matter what rules are adopted, that the bishops will be very reluctant to police each other within bishops' conferences, and that there's still a real possibility of Rome getting it wrong in any particular case.
And I understand that suspicion, and I think, you know, that there's enough history on this for people to be skeptical. But that is why we need to have greater transparency in informing the people of God about what happens in these cases. But you're asking me, what do I think? No, my sense is, and I've, you know, followed this pretty closely, that the Pope at least is absolutely clear about it, and he's been very straight with the bishops, and a number of bishops have been stood down over it. And it's very easy to stand a bishop down under this edict, because actually you don't have to establish criminal negligence. All they have to be is, frankly, incompetent in their dealings on this issue. The Pope will say, I need your resignation. And they have been doing that. Yep.
And so what comes next, briefly, is that what's the next step that Catholics should look for? You said that the summit is the beginning of a whole series of reforms that are being talked about, and some of them will take a while to adopt and others will take a while to implement. But what's next on the horizon?
Well, I think the most important thing is to turn the church worldwide into a crusader on this issue, for the church to become a leader, frankly, in this. And just to go back to a point that I didn't finish, which was why did the Pope begin his speech with referencing the wider picture of abuse? Because at the heart of the exploitation of children, whether it's, you know, people trafficking or other kinds of abuse of children, or child slavery or child soldiers, is the same, if you like, demonic use of power over. And, you know, at the heart of the gospel is power of service, which starts, you know, with the dignity of every human being and the idea of service of humanity. That's what the church stands in defense of. And that's why the Pope wanted to begin that way, because he wanted to say to the Africans, many of whom, by the way, say, this isn't our issue, child sex abuse isn't our issue, we have other issues about, you know, children, who say, well, actually, it's the same thing. You know, and it's a bit like with Laudato Si, when the Pope said, look, if you care about the unborn, you have to care about ecology. And if you care about the environment, you have to care about the unborn. It's all part of the same thing. And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing the Pope move the church really into this direction of becoming a major campaigner, promoter of the welfare of children worldwide. That's really what we're looking for now.
Austin Ivory, thank you again for joining us and updating us on this important story.
Been good to be with you, Matt. Thank you.